Thanks for coming along this morning. My name's Brendan Council. Got a couple of my colleagues here from EY to talk about cyber risk. So just introduce them. Dave Miller and Robert Menzies are both senior managers working in EY's actuarial service practice for around 10 years. Dave specialises in providing risk management advice to wealth management and life insurance clients and is secretary of the LIWMPC. In his free time, Dave is particularly interested in the development of autonomous cars and both the moral and insurance issues that it creates. Rob is focused on advising financial services institutions on credit, market and operational risk modelling. Rob is now leveraging his experience of advising clients on operational risk measurement into the realm of quantifying the potential economic loss arising from cyber risk. Together, they have been assisting companies in qualifying their exposure to potential cyber threats and assisting with cyber uplift programs and insurance optimisation. Welcome, Dave and Rob, and I'll pass over to you, Dave, now.
Thanks very much, Brendan. Look, and today's presentation is meant to dovetail a little bit into yesterday's one by the Cyber Working Group. And basically what we want to cover today is how one approach that we see taking off in the market to assist in modelling cyber risk. There's actually a really interesting question at the end of yesterday's presentation around how are people quantifying their cyber exposure. And that's certainly an approach that we want to discuss today in terms of how to model cyber risk, and then particularly from a general insurance perspective, how this modelling approach can help general insurance companies make smart, strategic decisions about their direct impact from cyber loss and also their indirect losses. Because one thing's for certain, and I was disappointed we didn't get the question from the chair at the start, because I was all revved up to answer about why people should be thinking or how people should be thinking differently at the end of today's presentation. And I think if you're a company, and one of our theses is very much if you're an organisation these days, you're not only exposed to direct attacks from cyber and cybercrime directly targeted towards yourself, but in fact you're at risk from a number of different attack vectors, including those coming from your third-party suppliers, if you're an insurance company, from the businesses and clients that you insure, and also throughout your organisational structure from your parents and your various subsidiaries. And so our agenda today is basically broken down into four topics here, or six topics even, if you can count properly. The cyber threat landscape, and we're going to provide a bit of an overview of some of the high-profile cyber attacks. Those of you that attended the working group yesterday, what we're really going to focus on here is the various attack vectors that people have used to perpetrate those crimes. The response of businesses, insurers, governments and other organisations to those attacks, and broadly the evolving nature of cybercrime over the last 10 years or so. The current cyber insurance landscape and how we've got to where we have today. And then also, as Brendan pointed out in the introduction, taking the lessons learned from the operational and enterprise risk management work that Rob and I do to develop a best-of-breed cyber risk modelling approach. Looking at that firstly from an insurer's perspective as a direct target, and then from their perspective of being part of the supply chain as well as being risk aggregators. And finally, we'll spend some time looking at the risk-reward trade-offs that can be quantified to support strategic decisions of both insurers and their insured. Now, earlier this year in February, tens of thousands of FPOS machines throughout the world started spewing out some very strange-looking dockets. There were bizarre pictures of some computers and also some giant robots attached with a signature that said, "With the love from the hacker god himself." Others said, "Your printer has been pawned," and started flowing out heaps and heaps of paper. And some told them, "For the love of God, please close this port." Now, it was actually reported to be a British secondary school student who used the name Stack Overflowing, something that if anybody's ever compiled code would hate to see that come up. And he was basically, when interviewed, said he was annoyed by the parlous state of computer security and had decided to perform a light-hearted public service by demonstrating just how easy it was to seize control of all of these point-of-sale machines. And so whether or not it was him, and then arguably it may not have been, I think the point of that story, that anecdote, is that cybercrime and cyber risks are an organisational-wide issue. Attackers are taking advantage of vulnerabilities in whole operating environments. Sure, none of those individual restaurants and retail outlets were targeted by that. And as we go through some of the high-profile threats on the next page when Rob comes up, I think it's worthwhile sitting back and reflecting how many of these individual organisations have actually just been caught up in a big, wide net, a big random scattergun approach from a number of cyber criminals and organised gangs, and how much of them are really targeted attacks at the individual organisations.
Thanks, Dave. Up on the page here, I've got a number of different examples, and this is, must reiterate, it's just a selection of a range of examples of cyber attacks that have occurred in recent years. If we listed every single cyber attack, I'm sure we'd have reams and reams of paper. I'll talk through a couple of interesting ones, and what I want to draw out from this is the range of attacks is quite varied. The perpetrators of these attacks range from government organisations to secondary school students downloading pieces of software. And the avenues of attack are very wide and varied. So if I talk around, you know, TalkTalk, TalkTalk's a UK telecommunications company. What's interesting about this is that it was believed to be the biggest data breach in UK history. The losses on that were disclosed in terms of being £42 million of losses from, you know, customers leaving their contracts and future customers not signing in with TalkTalk. What was interesting about this is that it was not so much what happened, because the data breach or the size of the data breach turned out not to be that big. It was done, ended up being done by a 17-year-old student who downloaded a piece of software from the internet and used it to find weak websites and attacked TalkTalk because he saw vulnerabilities. He was just trying to show off to his friends. What compounded this, though, was the handling of the media by the CEO and the management of the organisation, being able to unable to answer questions on whether or not their customer data was encrypted or not. Not understanding what a SQL injection attack is, not being able to explain and articulate. So the media and the public thought it was a lot worse than it actually was. The other interesting one here is Target. So Target had the biggest data breach of customer credit card data in the US. It was rather a simple attack. They'd installed skimming software on point-of-sale systems, targeting one of the Black Friday sales. What's interesting about this is that 6 months before, Target had invested nearly $2 million in anti-malware protection software. And they had a team in, I think it was Bangladesh, that was monitoring for presence of malware on their systems. After the hack or the criminal enterprise installed the software on the point of sale, that would upload the credit card details to a compromised data warehouse within Target systems. They then needed to get a piece of malware onto Target systems in order to extract the credit card information. Now, when they uploaded that piece of malware, they'd already had this new software in place. Red flags went off and alerted the company to there being malware being uploaded onto the system, but they did nothing. And so the hack was successful, and they took all the credit card information when they could have prevented it. Then, very briefly on the Sony one, so this was purported to be from the North Korean, North Koreans in retaliation to a movie that was released that was quite derogatory to the North Korean leader. And so it was in response to a lot of hacktivists that are kind of bringing out. Yahoo, another interesting one, that there was a takeover by Verizon, the US telecommunications company, and it was nearly derailed by two large data breaches of this $4.2 billion takeover. And then, you know, banks are also kind of classic targets, being the custodians of money in the system. You've got anything from the simple end of, skimming of credit card information from ATMs, quite the small end of the scale. But then you've also got very targeted attacks, and not just the banks, but also the systems and the payment processing they use. There was nearly an $81 million theft from the Bangladeshi Central Bank, where they targeted SWIFT, which processes all the payments in between all the different banks. It wasn't successful because there was a spelling mistake that was identified and it was stopped. But it just shows how easy and how connected we are, and how, you know, software and providers can be targeted, and you can have thefts from a range of different organisations. Then another couple of ones, and the Ashley Madison was quite well publicised only because of the compromising information of people that were subscribing to that site. It was, if you're not aware, it was a website for people that wanted to have affairs. So people were very concerned about this.
And it was probably incumbent upon me as doing my research for today's presentation to go through that database, Rob, and your name wasn't there, which is fortunate for your wife. I've let her know that. Nor was yours, Brendan. I don't know if that's true or not. But
the question is, did you find yourself?
No, I didn't. Certainly not on that side, I didn't. Interesting, right? A number of those are all direct attacks there. If we look at the NSA and we look at the CIA, both of those actually had the ignominy, I guess, of some of their actual own internal hacking capabilities released online. Last year, the NSA, in August 2016, by a group called Shadow Brokers, and then the CIA earlier in March this year. But I'd like to draw your attention to Reddit and Twitter. So both of them were actually a target or an indirect target through a group, a very sophisticated denial-of-service attack, distributed denial-of-service attack, that actually went through DIN. For those of you that know DIN or don't know DIN, basically what DIN is an internet router. So it takes your IP address and makes sure you end up at the right site. And by hitting DIN, that was the weak point in this, and it brought down a huge number of websites, including Twitter and Reddit. So, sure, they may have been really the focus of the attack, but it was through a vulnerability well outside of their system. And that's something to keep in mind, in your own businesses about who are you relying on in terms of your supply chain. But it's not all criminal motivation and whether it be external or internal. Sometimes it can be accidental leaks. And if you look at Allianz and NIB and the Red Cross earlier this year, each one of those was about posting databases online and people being able to find those databases through port scanning, through a whole bunch of different techniques. And each one of those only came to light when people informed the companies, which is an incredibly scary thing, right? So all that data was up there to be able to be taken, filtered, sold in certain cases. And the first thing the companies knew was when somebody contacted them about it. Both the Kansas Heart Hospital and anyone that's ever needed medical assistance, both the Kansas Heart Hospital and then that very recent one around the NHS, both of those were susceptible or fell foul to ransomware, right? So that's individual people clicking on some emails, being phished, and then basically their computer shutting down. And those of you in the working group yesterday heard a little bit about the NHS one, which also FedEx was equally compromised last week. Perhaps not a life and death thing that perhaps some of the NHS one was made out to be, but certainly if you're a manufacturer and you're relying on FedEx to bring and distribute a whole bunch of your parts for your just-in-time process, and FedEx is unable to do so because their systems are compromised, that's incredibly impactful on your business, even if you weren't the direct target. So cybercrime is a big business these days. Today's attackers, I would argue, are more organised. They're not just opportunists. They have significant funding. And really importantly, they're patient. And they're very sophisticated. And they'll often gain access and wait until just the right moment to pounce. Rob will give you a bit more of an understanding about the threat landscape.
Yep. Okay, so some interesting statistics up here and just kind of reiterating what Dave and I have been talking about in terms of the committers of these attacks are wide and varied. You've got both outside and inside threats. So you've got also disgruntled employees or as Dave was mentioning about the Red Cross Blood Service, there was accidental posting and by someone internal. You've got the state affiliates, so it's not just the Russias, the Chinas, the North Koreas, but you've also got the Americans, the Brits and the Australians as well in this space of conducting cyber attacks. You've also got kind of the common one, the common one that people think about is organised crime. So there are big organised crime groups trying to target and steal from various organisations. Could be to try and steal directly from customers or could also be to steal industry secrets. And I think the victims, it's quite wide and varied. We've talked a little bit around the supply chain. There's not just one nature or one profile of a target in cyber risk. You can have organisations target or you can have suppliers targeted. And sometimes you find weaknesses as well. So there was, I'm not sure if you've heard of Heartbleed, which was a weakness found in OpenSSL, which is a very common encryption protocol used across the web, was found to have a security flaw that will give hackers unrestricted access and be able to read encrypted traffic. There was also a breach of RSA, who provide a lot of the encryption software for banks and for corporates to secure their intellectual property as well as their customers, and they had a number of their algorithms compromised and had to reissue tokens to try and control this. But I think from a wide range of this, it's important that you know, you understand that there's a range of different attackers, there's a range of different targets, and that the landscape itself is constantly evolving. New weaknesses and avenues are constantly being found.
Yeah, that's right. Do you want to talk about some of the responses?
Yes, I do. There we go. And so, I mean, the collective responses, I won't go through every single one here, but just these kind of range from how does an organisation, what is their crisis action plan, how are they going to respond to the market in the case of a data breach or a cyber event happening? What is the impact on the business, both from a direct financial loss in terms of money being stolen, but also indirect in terms of loss of business, impact on share price? So there's a lot of this kind of activity in terms of responses, both, you know, from what organisations do and what costs and expenses they suffer, which is kind of driving the need and driving this need for insurance in this space. Now, we mentioned concentration risk a bit in terms of suppliers being targeted and why we've got this kind of graphic, and Dave was telling me this is a graphic novel created about Apple's terms and conditions, trying to illustrate the nth degree of detail that goes in the terms and conditions. And the message here is that if a supplier gets compromised or a piece of software gets compromised, you've probably got no recourse to that supplier. There's probably some line in the terms and conditions that prevents you having any claim against them for any bugs or defects in their software that leads to these losses.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things I thought that came out of yesterday's working group and was around the regulatory enforcement around data breaches, right? So we're quite privileged to have access to the last couple of years of data from the banking and credit system in the US, from their mandatory breach reporting notification. And that same setup is happening in the EU from next year, and also Australia from early next year as well. And it'll be very interesting to see what kind of insights we get out of that mandatory breach reporting. So this graphic here up on the screen is shows from the banking and credit sector in the US, basically shows the number of losses and the significance of those losses, so the size of those losses. The shading has to do with the frequency of these losses, and the size has to do with the amount of data that was lost in each one of those. And the key message here is you look at the different sizes and the shading. So you look at Amex down the bottom there, a frequent attacker and loser of some data there. Clearly, you know, very valuable information there, customer data, credit card information, funds data, etc. And then you look at someone like Citibank there or the Bank of New York, MC. You know, there's such a wide variety of the different attacks and data losses here, in particular data losses, that makes such a variability in terms of what insurers are going to do to provide cover, what individual companies are going to do to take out cover or to think about how they optimise their IT spend versus some of the insurance. And on the next slide, to complicate matters, it shows something that general insurers love, and that's, you know, claims lags and analysis by accident year. So you've got accident year across the bottom there, and the call out in the top right of the screen there is that there's a significant delay in these reporting breaches. And as I said before, in the cases of, you know, Allianz, in the case of NIB, in the case of the Red Cross Blood Bank, those only came to light because people notified the organisations themselves, right? So there is a significant lag in the claims that are actually hitting the general insurance companies, and in this case from the US in terms of the when people are reporting the breaches. And that has is also borne out in the Ponemon report that came out just a couple of weeks ago from their 2016 work. And what this chart shows is, firstly, the average time it takes to identify a data breach, and then secondly, the average time it takes to contain those data breaches once identified. Scarily, it takes 6 months to identify, on average, up to nearly 6 months, to identify a data breach in an organisation, then another 2 months to contain it. And what Ponemon's found is that if it takes you over 100 days to find a data breach, it's going to increase your cost to rectify that by 65%. And if it takes you over 30 days to contain it, it's going to add an additional 30% to your costs. So turning our focus now to the cyber insurance landscape itself. Historically, I guess these products were sold as add-ons, right? So, you know, like a lot of good product development, brokers and advisors have come and said, well, this is what our clients want, or we need to get a bit of extra premium through the door. And these products have been offered by general insurers in the US basically as an add-on, and to keep their clients happy and the brokers and advisors happy and remain that one-stop shop for their clients. There was initial losses and have still been losses on some of those or a lot of the various products that are out there, particularly in the US and now through Europe. You heard yesterday one of the stats from a PwC report was that I think there's about, from 2015, there's about $2.5 billion worth of premium going through, and interestingly there's about $20 million worth of Australian premium. Sentinel released a report just a couple of weeks ago, so their figures on the 2016 market was that number's up to almost $4 billion, although it's shaded in some uncertainty. And I guess that's something that you guys, I'd really encourage you to take out of the presentation today, is just how much uncertainty there is around cyber insurance at the moment. For those of you that were in that working group presentation yesterday, there was a big table up on the board there saying what's covered, when's, who, how, what sort of recourse you've got, and there's a whole bunch of question marks against all of the cyber product there. And I think that sings you know, really loudly to the product that is there out there in the market at the moment. And losses, I think, have really come because the products that are out there at the moment vary wildly in the types of coverage that are offered, in terms of the policy wording, in terms of the underwriting approach, and certainly in terms of the premiums that are being charged. There's limited historical data that Rob will go into in a little bit, and there's wide variation as a result in the claim size, and you saw that information around the data breach, is just how wide and varied the attack nature is and the size of the data losses when they've occurred. There has been big issues in defining loss, right? So are the companies themselves complicit? Have they themselves contributed to creating some of the weaknesses that have been exposed? Or is it a third party, as I said before? You know, is it a third party that you have relied on as part of a partnership that has actually been attacked? The key thing, I think, that to take out of this slide is those last couple of points, right? With $4 billion going through the global industry at the moment, and that is increasing between 25 to 30% year on year, and in some markets, you know, up to 60% through the early development now in Asia. It's certainly hitting boards and senior management and insurance companies, and it's absolutely, from the work that Rob and I are doing, hitting ordinary businesses within and outside, certainly outside the financial services organisations. Customers' complexity and their understanding of the cyber risks and cyber crime that they face is developing, right? Their understanding, the exposure that they have as part of an ongoing operational risk and business continuity management planning, and they're beginning to understand and investigate the different cyber products that are out there and work out whether they should be spending on IT, spending on ways throughout their organisation, whether it be employee education, whether it be the analysis of their vendors as to how best to allocate their funds and which IT projects to fund and what sort of schedule they're taking. So I'm going to pass over to Rob to take you through a few slides as to how we're seeing organisations and how we're helping organisations to get ahead of that curve.
Thanks, Dave. So I think, firstly, the question we're posing is, you know, are insurers investing enough in cyber risk modelling? Because what we're seeing in terms of working with our clients is that, you know, the clients are going through that classic insurance a trade-off discussion in terms of, do they invest in additional controls or in security in their IT systems versus the cost of those and how much that's perceived to reduce their risk in terms of their cyber exposure. Also going through that discussion in terms of, well, how do you quantify the size of my cyber risk using techniques that we draw from ERM in terms of, you know, quantifying a value at risk type measure to understand the exposure to cyber risk, and then also looking in terms of, you know, of the world of economic losses that we can perceivably lose from cyber risk, of those, what are insurable, and what's our threshold for tolerance between insurance or accepting the risk and investing in IT to compensate for this. And so forward-looking boards are trying to really ask these questions and promoting the role of the CISO or the Chief Information Officer to understand and get a better handle on this type of risk they're exposed to, and then working out when and what parts to invest in terms of IT and also what insurance to buy. So the question now is, well, how do we go about modelling? And I think the working group rightly pointed out yesterday that the kind of two obvious challenges being data. There's very kind of lack of cohesive data sources. There's some mandatory breach reporting coming from the US and the changes coming through Europe and Australia next year in terms of mandatory disclosure of data breaches. The data sources themselves are inconsistent and fragmented, so trying to get some sense out of all these disjointed data sources is going to be quite challenging. You've got the issue of censoring, so you're not being aware of the full universe of data breaches, as well as details about what those breaches are. You've also got the kind of modelling change, or how do you take this data and model in an environment where the regulation's changing, where the whole landscape of the threats is evolving and changing over time, the different axes of where the threat's coming from, where are the weaknesses in the supply chain. But the other thing we want to draw out is the very people challenge, which the people element to cyber risk in terms of, from an employee clicking on an email and being attacked by spear phishing and having malware installed in their machine. From the example we talked through earlier in terms of Target, having the alerts and being alerted that malware was on their systems but doing nothing about it, and as well as kind of this drive to have a holistic and data-driven approach. Now, these are many of the same challenges that are faced by operational risk modelling over the last 15 years or so. And how do we take this kind of very difficult risk to quantify and make some sense and understand of the size and nature of this risk? Which is now I'm going to talk through what we're calling a scenario-based approach. And this is bringing the kind of best-of-breed operational risk type approach. We're particularly focused, in scenario-based, is particularly focused towards the tail end of the risk and saying that where there is limited or not enough reliable data in order to draw some reliable conclusions. So we need to go through a scenario-based approach to draw out some of the risks and features of this type of risk. So generally it's a three-stage process. There's a lot of iteration through this way, but we start with kind of a identification process. So what are the big ticket cyber risks that an organisation is faced with? There might be a risk library. I know EY has a risk library in terms of our cyber colleagues. They have a risk library in terms of different attacks and ways of getting in. To whittle that down to the key ones or the key weaknesses that the organisation is exposed to, and it might be a data breach or it might be a compromisation of some a supplier or third-party system. Then working out in terms of what, from a qualitative view, what the big material risks are going to be. We're then taking each of those scenarios and trying to draw out a credible scenario. How could that risk eventuate? To draw a storyline to say, well, if it's a data breach, how would the data breach come about? Who is a likely threat to perpetrate that risk? And draw out a storyline of the sequence of events. Now, I won't go into too much detail of the example because Dave will talk very shortly about a real-life example that we've taken through one of our clients on. But the purpose of this scenario workshop is to draw that storyline, and through that process of drawing the storyline, draw out what are the critical assets that are going to be targeted, where are the weaknesses, what's going to drive that risk in terms of both direct and indirect financial loss or economic loss, and also what are the key controls and mitigants that the organisation has that might reduce the size of the exposure. And once we have that narrative and these identifiers, we draw that into a very kind of descriptive model of what the risk looks like. Going through an iterative process, trying to assign some of the assumptions to those, keeping it very compartmentalised to get the buy-in from the scenario participants so they can understand what they're trying to quantify, understand how much data could be stolen and how lead times in terms of identification, to build out a distribution that kind of describes the shape of the loss that could eventuate. Then adding on to that, if we start investing in IT or investing in controls, how can we change that shape of the distribution and make investments or worthwhile investments to change that shape? I might pass over now to Dave to talk through a real-life example so you can get a bit of a touch and feel of what this looks like.
Yeah. And I think that last point was really critical, Rob. Around the IT controls, they're clearly not something you can just pick up averages on, right? Individual companies have different high-risk and high-value targets in their organisation, so each one has different vulnerabilities, and it's really important when you run these kind of scenario approaches to have the right people in the room to understand and to tailor these scenarios to exactly what the conditions are within those organisations. Because what this does do is it helps focus the business and the business on the outcomes that they can take. And actually, it's really interesting. One of the things that we found, and probably a bit of a byproduct, and something that we didn't necessarily think was going to come out, and certainly foresee that was going to come out of these workshops that we've undertaken, is actually some of the softer, well, maybe they're not softer, but some of the strategy at the back end of the containment piece that hadn't really been tested by these organisations. So the integration of the media strategies, getting the marketing and the communications people involved in understanding what their reactive media strategies would be in these kind of cases really helps to contain and to contain the losses and provide certainty at the back end. Because one of the biggest loss drivers here, and those of you again that were in the working group presentation yesterday, sure, there's regulator penalties and various enforcements and things like, if credit card data gets stolen, there's a significant cost to providing ongoing credit monitoring services. But one of the huge costs here is the future loss of business. So current customers getting out and new customers never coming in the door. So this is an example scenario, and we'll work through it in a little bit of detail. The one we ran with one of the insurers, it was very interesting working with the actuaries, because there's also this concept of direct losses and then that indirect loss. So lots of the business are really concerned with the indirect loss component, like the future sales and fallaways in renewals and things like that. And the actuaries are sitting there going, geez, they're big numbers, that's going to have a massive capital impact. And then you kind of go, well, actually, that's probably going to have less of a capital impact. So from some of the valuation and capital actuaries, there's less of an impact in some of these scenarios. But from a business and profitability side, it's that's clearly high on their agenda. And so, these are things that we've gone through a learning curve on in terms of the different audiences that we're playing these things back to and the different losses that individual people are concerned about. In this particular case, and as I said, this was a live case and a real thing for an insurance company. So this was an insurance company looking at their own direct threats. So this attack eventuated from effectively a malicious insider. They were somebody that the scenario was around somebody who felt and knew that their job was going to be made redundant and go offshore. And basically what they did is they were somebody who had already had a fairly privileged access to particular databases, and in this case the premium rating engine. And what they did is they at home researched a bunch of ways to create some malware. And some ransomware or really just malware and encryption software. They were able to create a local username on the system to then use a presentation laptop like this one in a meeting room to upload that information anonymously, so leave no trace, and then have the malware sit there for about a month after the employee left the organisation until it was finally activated. And we see that occur in a number of cases. So this software that's able to monitor things. So, particular scenarios we've looked at as well are around accounts payable systems and rerouting payments, right? Either directly through their own systems or in the intermediary steps between the organisation going to the bank. And looking at the history or the signature of different payment volumes over time can pick up the big days, right? The day where the payroll tax goes off to the bank or your POIG tax goes off to the ATO. They're obviously key days that you can route that information. In this case, after a month, it was enacted, and then the business operations guys found that they couldn't access the premium rating engine and caught up IT.
And so we found that the best way to conduct these scenarios is actually in two steps, to separate all the IT guys. And particularly with this client, they were looking at a big cyber uplift program and tried to understand, well, which steps in their uplift program are going to have the most impact. And so if we're squeezed for budget, which they were being, which of the items can we cut and how much value can we show from our entire uplift program? Because there's so much of this that's an opportunity cost, right? And it's a very difficult thing to show. You're investing all this money to protect you against, you know, future potential issues rather than, you know, maybe going and investing in a distribution channel and paying additional commissions to get extra business through the door today. So the back half of that is then really around the firm responses and the business impacts. And so how we found that these things work best is cut the workshops off at the end of the attack and then play that back to the rest of the business to understand, you know, having already understood the context of what the valuable assets were, et cetera, how the firm response and the actual conditions within the business itself drives the final loss. And so that example was tailored to embedding some ransomware or some encryption software within an insurer by a rogue employee who's about to lose his job. But it could just have easily been an organised criminal group exploiting a vulnerability in a system of one of your suppliers. So whether you're an insurer or another financial services organisation or, you know, a number of the guys that we work with that are outside of the financial services industry altogether, these kind of things are reality. And these, you know, and so these criminal organisations, whether targeting yourself or not, are hitting your suppliers and can ultimately compromise your own business. And so if you're an insurer, there's a number of different things here that are going to impact your cyber plan and your cyber defence plan and the strategy that your CIO and your CISO have in place and hopefully your CRM because, you know, the chief or the CRO. So, you know, hopefully the chief risk officer is ultimately the person that should be owning cyber. It shouldn't be out there on the side. It should absolutely, in Rob and my view, be part of the broader risk stable, right? And it's not only as an insurance company or as a financial services company your own response to direct attacks from cyber, but you have, as we've said, the vulnerability of your supply chains, your parent companies and your subsidiaries, and then absolutely as an insurance company, the insured businesses. And one of the things I'd really like to draw out at this point is, you know, if you're a general insurance company, and even in life insurance companies as well, there's, you know, plenty of talk around concentration risk. And it's very easy in a general insurance company to say, well, you know, oh, look, there's an East Coast low, you know, there's lots of houses in this particular area, this area is susceptible to flooding, hail, etc. We're massively, you know, overweight in high-end cars from an auto insurance perspective. But one of the things that I'm not seeing in the industry at the moment, and perhaps it's out there, it certainly may be, is a real understanding about the concentration risk that insurance companies face from the operational risk and the business continuity insurance that they offer, and particularly when they have cyber add-ons. And so how many businesses are going to be attacked or how many businesses are going to be interrupted if, you know, one of your key supply chain goes down? What happens if, you know, Amazon, the web hosting services from Amazon get hacked and a whole bunch of data goes out? If you're an insurance company, from a direct attack point of view, you know, one of the things, and I'm not sure if you mentioned it, Rob, around this evolution of you know, enterprise data warehouses and group data warehouses, where basically all of the information in your entire organisation is being sucked into these, you know, one location, so people can do all the fantastic data analytics and everything that people are doing on that data. That's a fantastic place. If that's not secured or if that's hosted in the cloud and you don't really understand the security around the cloud, or even if you do and it is hacked, there's a huge amount of personal data in there. You know, it may be who you're insured, but particularly around claims data and health data, you know, a lot of professional indemnity data, claims and all sorts of things that would be terrible if they got out and really hurt insurance companies. So the last couple of points there on that slide is really around how companies are increasing their cyber resilience and the different items within their cyber management plans and cyber investment plans that they're taking. So there's four things there. So protective measures, and they're really the things that are stopping these attacks actually occurring, right? But the reality is that these attacks are occurring and they're going to continue to occur and probably at a much higher frequency going forwards. And so the next two points are really important, and we're seeing that they have huge impacts on the size of the losses that are being modelled. So monitoring programs, and that's, you know, Rob's point before about having systems in place that are creating logs so that post hoc, so once you know that the breach has happened or that the event, the cybercrime has taken place, that you're able to go back and actually understand what's happened, understand which systems have been compromised, and then you can get out there as a CEO and confidently talk to the media and say, well, you know, this is what's happened, it's contained, you know, we're good to go, this is the information that's been lost, it was encrypted, it wasn't encrypted, it's partially encrypted, when it was extracted, it was corrupted, you know, all of the kind of things that will provide confidence in the market. And then that containment and subsequent remediation plan. So there's a lot of things. So focusing specifically on Australia, one of the things that we're seeing, so there's the Privacy Commissioner and the fines that they can levy. Those fines aren't particularly large at an organisational level, so they're only up to $1.8 million, but it's the subsequent losses paid to individual people, and some of those are like thousands and thousands of dollars per customer. And you think about what that might mean. We haven't seen that happen in Australia, and if I were a betting person, there's no way that the Privacy Commission would levy thousands of dollars per client across a 50,000 client breach, right? Because that's going to bankrupt a number of organisations. But it certainly is a threat there of the size of the fines that they can levy or the compensation that they can levy for individual people. And then finally, that whole idea about insurance from organisations, as Rob talked to about prioritising between the IT spend and the insurance spend, and whether organisations like insurers should be taking out the reinsurance. So on our final slide, before we open the floor to questions, we just want to talk about the nine, I guess, key points around where we think strategic focus is needed by insurers.
Thanks, Dave. And I'll just kick off with the first couple of points. But I think, firstly, I think from an insurance company point of view, it's first to look internally, to look at your own kind of cyber risks, developing robust cyber risk strategies and going through some kind of testing process to understand how robust they are and make changes if they're not proving to be effective. Dave talked through an example of when going through that scenario with a client, they realised that their current strategy wasn't effective and wouldn't be able to effectively talk to the media and respond in a timely manner. There's also, implementing vulnerabilities in legacy IT systems, they're kind of the quick wins. You often, even to this day, Windows XP is quite commonly used in systems. It's no longer supported. It's not getting security patches. There's a range of different legacy systems that I'm sure have a lot of different weaknesses and vulnerabilities. So focusing on those and prioritising investment for the quick wins. Also kind of, we've talked a little bit around concentration risk and kind of many different ways it can arise, but one of them is on vendors. The vendors that you're using, making sure that if a vendor gets hacked, you're not going to be susceptible to any loss that arises. So building in kind of cyber risks and understanding cyber risks of your vendors as part of the due diligence, as well as kind of building in kind of cyber resilience as part of a broader operational risk strategy and really having that focus and focus and drive on cyber risk to understand your exposure.
I think establishing and involving incident response teams is an absolute no-brainer. You saw the data around the reduction in cost if you can get your teams on the ground. So as an insurance company, partnering with your clients and offering that as a service is an absolute no-brainer. The risk-reward trade-off there is free money, you'd be leaving cash on the table otherwise. I certainly think that creating and focusing the product development around providing proper cyber protection products is going to limit some of the losses that insurers offering the original products have certainly faced, and particularly clarifying exclusions between the different types of products. One of the comments that the working group said yesterday was there's so much complexity in these products and other similar products that are being offered. It would be very interesting to see if there was a simplified product that had clarified some of those exclusions. Getting close to your clients, I think, again, is a no-brainer. We're seeing that happening in the life insurance industry and in the general insurance industry, trying to understand your customers as much as you can, through gimmicks probably, maybe not gimmicks, like, Fitbits, and certainly, general insurance companies offering things like, defensive driving courses, reducing your premiums and the like. I certainly think that getting close to your clients and providing them with opportunities, if they do A, B, C, D and E, that you're going to provide lower premiums to them. So giving them incentives in a structured way to improve their own outcomes and reduce their premiums is key. And finally, I think crucially, is to begin evaluating the concentration risk as an insurer as to what you're facing from the products you're writing yourself and from the businesses that you're doing business with. Thanks very much, guys.
Very interesting presentation. We've probably got only enough time for one or two questions. Was there any questions from the floor? If you do have a question, just please, if you could come to the mic and state your name and organisation before for the recording.
Hi, I'm George from Cominshaw. I just wanted to check with you if there's any sort of response from the regulators in terms of cybersecurity, because most of what we're talking about now is trying to get solutions as commercial practitioners as opposed to like regulation.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I haven't heard a great deal. I mean, so if you look at APRA and ASIC, for example, I don't think that there's much necessarily coming out of those organisations. I don't know if you've...
I know they've got some regulation in terms of banks and other organisations outsourcing certain functions, making sure that there's proper controls and reviews in place.
Yeah.
I think
that's right. I don't think there's necessarily any particular overlay to what's already there from outsourcing arrangements and things like that.
There is the mandatory breach reporting coming in February, March next year. So there'll be more disclosures in terms of data breaches.
Okay, I think time's up because people are coming in for the next session. So please join me in thanking Dave and Rob.